ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Henry Kissinger is turning 100. Now, Bruce Shapiro, I know we've got more important issues to talk about, but are you going to the birthday party?
You know, I suspect that I'm not on the invitation list. interestingly, with Kissinger, this wouldn't be because of my politics. It would be because I'm not famous enough. I'm just not a big enough guy for the Henry list, I'm afraid. Look, this is, it's an interesting and historic birthday of an interesting and complicated and historic guy. What I find especially striking as we think about Kissinger and his legacy is how the worldview which powered both his genuine achievements in fostering detente and beginning negotiations for Mideast peace and all that in the 1970s, and which fostered the war crimes and massive human rights violations with which he is tied up, Cambodia, Chile, I could go on and on and on. That worldview, which he promoted so effectively through the Nixon years, is a bipolar worldview involving U.S. and then Soviet spheres of influence, in which essentially the balance of power can be maintained only if we recognize and acknowledge U.S. spheres of influence versus Russian spheres of influence. That same argument is now primarily present in the world in the language of Vladimir Putin and in the language of those who are seeking to justify or at least minimize the consequences of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Putin is claiming that Ukraine is part of Russia's sphere of influence, and Europe and NATO and the U.S. have been undermining his rights in that region. And that's why we're in this war, right? The world has moved on in many ways from Kissinger's worldview, but not when it comes to Mr. Putin and not when it comes to those who would apologize for him. It's an interesting thought.
Okay, let's look to other matters. Joe has dodged a default on the U.S. debt. Tell me what he and House Speaker have done.
Well, this is something which comes up, of course, every couple of years in our strange system in which Congress has to approve the debt of the United States. But it's consequential here, first of all, because it leads to $135 billion in cuts for next year. That would also delay the next debt default until after the 2024 election. But it's, this is notable. On the one hand, it's the kind of agreement you would expect in normal times that a Democratic president and a Republican House Speaker would pass, with some cuts in social programs, with clawing back of funds, with a bit of lowering of tax rates or delaying of tax enforcement on the richest people. There's a bunch of stuff in here which falls into the normal category. Some things that have upset progressive Democrats, raising the age for work requirements for food stamps. But it's mostly important as a test of divisions within Republican ranks. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, of course, became House Speaker Kevin McCarthy by making a whole bunch of deals with the Freedom Caucus, the Trump right. He installed some of those folks on the Rules Committee, which has to approve this thing. And now it's really very uncertain whether he can hold that Republican caucus together. Will the Republican Party in the House fracture over and fracture in a profound and enduring way over the debt ceiling.
I've got to ask, I've got to ask you this. The Donald, of course, wallows in debt. He must view it with some affection. What's his mob? How are they going to play this?
Well, there's his mob and then there's him. I mean, it's interesting because thus far, former President Trump has not said anything one way or another about the debt deal. His allies in the House, those in the Freedom Caucus, have been vociferously against this deal. And, you know, they can either sink the deal or, even if it passes, then challenge McCarthy's speakership. So there's, you know, there's a lot at stake from his allies. Whether or not Trump chooses to weigh in on this will reflect his assessment of his own political interests, right? It's not about the principle of the thing. Like, does the Donald care if the government runs out of money? No, he doesn't, if it would mean 5 minutes more on the air for him. But, you know, he needs to decide whether his own political interests are best served by getting past this debt ceiling deal, having it off the table through the election so that he's not called on to speak about it again, or if he wants to simply stoke conflict, even at the cost of the U.S. defaulting on its obligations, running out of money sometime in June, which is the current estimate that Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen gives us. We've got only a few weeks here before the U.S. runs out of money. And while that sort of Damocles is always held over the public's head at these moments of, you know, debt ceiling tension, in this case, it really is up to Donald Trump to decide whether he wants to drive the country to the brink of fiscal calamity or wants to step back from this one.
We're having a Shapiro Wet with Bruce, and as you predicted, Biden somewhat miffed Australians by cancelling his trip here because he had to sort the mess out. In your view, how has Biden handled himself?
Biden has handled this in a very Joe Biden way, and in the way you would have expected. He has been consistently open to negotiation. He, don't forget, presents himself as a Democratic president capable of bipartisan negotiation. So this, in that sense, is a kind of win for him already. He's always been a moderate Democrat when it comes to fiscal spending and things like welfare reform. So the elements of this bill that anger some progressives are actually in line with the historic Joe Biden. And what's most interesting is that he has managed to protect, in the course of these negotiations, the majority of his Inflation Reduction Act wins over the course of the last year. So, you know, at least at this first phase of negotiation, he's come out on top, I think. Now, this has to not only pass the House, but it has to pass the Senate. And there are a lot of potential landmines in this for President Biden. So he is not out of the woods. But if he can bring the country back from fiscal crisis and do it without weeks and weeks and weeks of uncertainty that roil the financial markets, he's done his job, and by taking it off the table for the next 2 years, as this deal would do, he is certainly protecting himself and his team from having to deal with an emotional debt crisis in the middle of next year's elections.
Now I want you to become our theatre critic and review the duet with DeSantis and Elon Musk.
You know, in the many years that you and I have been talking about American politics, and in the many years I've covered it before that, I can't remember a national campaign with higher expectations that had such a catastrophic launch. I suppose you could go back to the Democrat former governor of Vermont, Howard Dean, winning the Iowa caucuses and then totally sinking his prospects by literally yowling, screaming into the TV cameras at the victory party afterwards. That might be the closest. But, you know, DeSantis is in a different position. DeSantis has, on the one hand, captured a lot of mainstream Republican support from institutional party people who want an alternative to Donald Trump. But he has completely failed, even before this, to capture the base, the primary base of the Republican Party, even though he's very deliberately pitched himself as governor of Florida as a post-Trump authoritarian, right? Waging culture war at every step. In this, he not only suffered from the technical failures of Twitter and the intellectual failures of Elon Musk, he really rambled a lot. It was hard to follow him. He just kept dropping culture war references that, unless you're very deep inside the language of right-wing chat rooms, were probably not going to make much sense to most primary voters. So Musk is not the candidate. DeSantis really has a lot of ground to make up here, and it's not clear that he can do that. And, you know, there's other Republicans who already have gone into the pond in the last week. Senator Tim Scott from North Carolina, along, of course, with Nikki Haley from South Carolina, along with Nikki Haley from the same state. The field is getting crowded, and the more crowded it gets, the stronger Donald Trump gets, and the more the sort of establishment support that is not connected to the primary electorate that DeSantis has claimed looks irrelevant. He's got a lot of ground to make up if he hopes to go anywhere out of this.
I hate the thought of giving our listeners nightmares, and this, of course, is a late-night program, but what you're saying is that Donald looks like he's got the nomination wrapped up.
Well, I wouldn't say that. We have a lot of time to go, a lot of primaries to go, but there's no doubt that his grip on the primary, the Republican primary electorate, remains as strong as ever. There's no doubt that his deep worldview, which includes, by the way, that very Henry Kissinger worldview in which human rights are not relevant, in which it's all about big power confrontation or collaboration, all of that, which is in some ways the less discussed part of Trump's legacy, that reconnection to the Nixon-Kissinger view of American foreign policy is devoid from any kind of human rights morality. Right now, that is the dominant and most likely to prevail scenario for the Republicans going forward.
Good on you, Bruce. Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor for The Nation and exec director of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.